Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Monday, the 1st of March, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 30 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9, and our very first episode in this new time slot of 8 o'clock Monday nights. So if you're tuning in for the first time and are wondering what is this show called Reality Check, well, Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific, and finally we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to try something a little bit different. We're going to do a four-way phone hookup to interview live three of the most moving and shaking LGBT rights activists in Australia. And we're going to find out from them what the future is for LGBT rights in this country. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at the other film with 9 nominations for this weekend's Oscars, running neck and neck against Avatar, and that film is The Hurt Locker. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, let's get into our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so, and a lot of marriage news to report this week. Some good, some bad. So first up, let's head to South America, and more specifically to Argentina. Now, regular listeners to Reality Check will remember the drama that took place in Argentina during November and December last year, after same-sex couple Alex Freire and José María Di Bello obtained a court order in Buenos Aires requiring the registry office there to issue them a marriage license. A few days later, another court overruled that decision, but finally on December 28th, they were able to get married way down in the southernmost province of Tierra del Fuego, becoming the first same-sex couple in Latin America to be officially legally married. Well, it looks like that whole tortuous process may be about to begin again, this time with another couple, Damián Bernat and Jorge Salazar Capón, because last Monday, February 22nd, a judge in Buenos Aires ordered the civil registry office there to legally marry the two men. Apparently, they've set a date for the wedding, but let's hope they make it that far, because I just read this morning that the public prosecutor in Buenos Aires has now appealed the case. I hope she loses that case and that Damián and Jorge will be able to become the second same-sex couple in Argentina to be legally married. Of course, this is all a bit silly, really, if every same-sex couple who wants to get married has to get a court order each time. So let's hope that the Argentinian legislature sees the writing on the wall and just passes a bill introducing marriage equality. There are a number of MPs in the Congress pushing for that right now. Or we could hope that the Supreme Court of Argentina rules that preventing same-sex marriage is unconstitutional and thus opens up marriage to everybody. I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Of course, depending on when that second Argentinian couple does get married, if they do get married, they might be the second couple in all of Latin America, or they might not, because same-sex marriage is due to come into effect this Thursday, March 4th, in Mexico City. So after that date, there will be lots of married same-sex couples in Latin America. So the Argentinian guys had better hurry if they want to be number two. Right, our second news item is also marriage-related, and it comes from the US state of Maryland, where the state attorney general, Douglas Gantzler, issued a legal opinion last Wednesday, February 24th, declaring that Maryland will now recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states or countries. Now, it's not exactly clear what legal effect this opinion has, but Maryland Governor Democrat Martin O'Malley said that he expects government agencies to comply with that determination and suggested that it has the force of law. So if that's true, that will put Maryland into the same situation as New York State, where same-sex marriages are legally recognized in the state, they just can't be performed there. And of course, this decision in Maryland is particularly relevant because in just a few days, its neighbor, Washington, D.C., will start performing same-sex marriages for the first time. Apparently, people are going to be able to apply for a marriage license there starting this Wednesday, March 3rd, and then should actually be able to have the wedding ceremonies starting Tuesday next week, March 9th. So, come Wednesday, Maryland residents won't have to go far to get married, a marriage that will then be recognized in their home state. So, advances there for marriage in Maryland and in Argentina, but let's go now to our third news item for today, which is a backward step for marriage, and that story comes from, oh, what a surprise, our own island continent of Australia. Well, what have we come to expect these days from our backward, narrow-minded, gutless politicians? And the bad news is that last Thursday, February 25th, the Senate finally voted on the marriage equality bill introduced by the Greens last June. And unfortunately, they voted against the bill. The vote was, in fact, 5 in favour and 45 against, with 26 senators absent from the chamber. And those 5 votes in favour were from the 5 Greens senators. The Labour, Liberal and National parties all oppose same-sex marriage and required their senators to vote along party lines. They didn't allow a conscience vote. So this is very disheartening when you actually see the people elected to represent you voting to perpetuate discrimination against you and deny your basic human rights. Although some LGBT rights groups out there are trying to put a positive spin on it by saying that many of those 26 senators who were absent chose to stay away because they disagree with the positions of their parties on the issue. So, in a way, their absence was the only form of protest open to them. Among those Labour senators who stayed away were Louise Pratt, whose partner is a transgender man, and also, arguably, the highest-profile LGBT person in the country, the newly promoted Minister for Climate Change, Energy Efficiency and Water, Penny Wong. And ironically, this blow for LGBT rights came just 2 days before the largest LGBT festival in the country, the annual Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, now in its 33rd year and still going strong. The parade took place on Saturday night, involving 135 floats and 9,500 performers. and with an estimated 300,000 people turning out to watch. Apparently, the theme of the Mardi Gras this year was the history of the world, although an historical theme wasn't really very apparent from the pictures that I saw. But there was definitely a lot of colour and sparkle on display on Saturday, and of course a lot of flesh. But the Mardi Gras came under particularly heavy criticism this year for becoming too corporate and losing sight of its community activist roots. Some community groups were even excluded from participating this year, whereas several large corporate sponsors were allowed to participate, even though they have nothing to do with LGBT issues. Of course, the Sydney Mardi Gras is actually a cultural festival that goes on for several weeks, and perhaps the most interesting event of the festival came in the early hours of this morning when American photographer Spencer Tunick did one of his nude human landscape photos in front of the Sydney Opera House. Organisers estimated that over 5,000 people stripped off to participate in the photo, meaning it just beats the crowd of 4,500 he gathered in Melbourne back in 2001, but got nowhere near his record crowd of 18,000 in Mexico City in 2007. And incidentally, I'm proud to say I participated in both the Melbourne and the Mexican photos. Yes, I'm one of those little pink pixels you see there in that writhing mass of humanity. Okay, that concludes our LGBT news roundup for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we're going to go for a world first, a live interview with three of Australia's most prominent and switched-on LGBT activists. So to find out what their prognosis is for LGBT rights in Australia, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
It's pure joy, 94.9.
Cruising for joy? It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the two songs you just heard there were La Vida Es Un Carnaval by the late, great, legendary Cuban salsa singer Celia Cruz, and also Più Bella Cosa by Italian singer Eros Ramazzotti. And I played those songs, particularly the Celia Cruz song, because of its carnivalesco feel, very appropriate for this Mardi Gras season. And it also gets us into the mood for what we're about to do now, a world first here on Reality Check, the bringing together of the three greatest minds in LGBT activism in Australia. You see, we now move into the part of the show where we normally undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal, but tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. Given the loss in the Senate last week of the marriage equality bill, I thought it might be an appropriate moment to take some time out from the heat of battle and talk to three of Australia's most switched-on and tuned-in LGBT activists to see how they think the future of LGBT rights in Australia is going to pan out. So, if technology is serving us well, we should have on the line from Hobart, Tasmania, the spokesperson for Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group, also involved with Australian marriage equality, and quite probably Australia's most prominent LGBT rights activist, Rodney Croom. Welcome to Reality Check, Rodney.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And on the line from Sydney, we have the spokesperson for the Australian Coalition for Equality and a regular lobbyist for LGBT rights in Canberra, a man with his finger on the pulse, Corey Earlham. Are you there, Corey?
Very flattered, Tony.
Great. And finally, here in the studio, sitting just across the desk from me, is another long-time LGBT rights activist, a former member of the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission from 2000 to 2009, and that is Jamie Gardner. Welcome, Jamie.
Good evening, Tony.
Good evening, Rodney and Corey.
Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Jamie.
Okay, so the question I want to ask you guys this evening basically comes down to this. What's left to achieve full legal equality for LGBT people in Australia? And how do you think these changes will eventually come about? So I want to deal with these issues in three parts. Marriage is the first, adoption the second, and then other reforms such as anti-discrimination laws. So starting with marriage, well, it was no surprise last week when the Senate voted 45-5 against the marriage equality bill, but still it was somehow disheartening to actually see them do it, especially as they're now swimming completely against the international current. We've now got same-sex marriage in 7 countries, plus 5 states of the US, plus a province of Argentina, and soon to start in Mexico City and Washington, D.C., and probably Portugal in a few weeks. Yet, our politicians can't seem to see the writing on the wall. So, was last week's Senate vote just a bump on the road? Is marriage equality inevitable in Australia? And if so, how long will it take, and how will it come about? Rodney, can I get your thoughts on this first?
Thanks, Tony. Obviously, last week's vote was disappointing, but like you said, probably not unexpected. And yes, the majority of MPs who voted against the marriage equality bill put up by the Greens, swimming against the current not only of the international trends, but also of Australian public opinion, which seems to be, according to recent opinion polls, 60% in favour of marriage equality. If we actually talk to individual MPs at a federal and at a state level, I think we find that most of them, on their individual conscience, particularly in the Labor Party, but also quite a few in the coalition, really don't have all that many problems themselves with the idea of same-sex marriage. The issue is that they're still afraid, I think, electorally, of those people who are, you know, dead against it. We're talking about evangelical fundamentalist Christians who seem to have a bit of a sway, at least electorally, in key outer urban marginal seats. And neither major party want to lose those seats, they believe, on the issue of same-sex marriage. And until we can convince them that there's an equal number or greater number of Australians who are concerned about this on the other side and may well change their votes accordingly, then the major parties will probably continue to enforce this strict line that same-sex marriage is not to be supported, not even talked about.
Well, can I bring you in there, Corey? Talking about convincing the politicians, you're a regular visitor to Canberra. Do you think we can convince the politicians?
No, I think Rodney is completely right when he talks about the fact that this is a political problem, not necessarily a policy problem. I think it would be dangerous to start going down a conscience vote, personally, because that would be a lot of work. And for example, the day of the vote, we had 48 people against same-sex marriage lobbying politicians on the ground in Canberra turned around in a week. Until we have a massive amount of people willing to actually put in time and change their vote on this, changes probably won't happen.
Oh, is that right? The other side was busy there in Canberra last week.
Mm-hmm. 48 different people from various groups around Australia walking through Parliament House, meeting with MPs, meeting with advisers, stating their view broadly on marriage, including an opposition to the bill.
Wow, so that's what we're up against. That's what we're competing against, effectively. Okay, Jamie, can I bring you in now? You're a man who has held office. What is your feeling on this?
Well, I've only been in a part-time appointment to an Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission. But look, I think that, yes, of course, you know, it's a bit of an insult to have that vote in Parliament, but I think it's actually quite exciting and an interesting one, especially with what Corey says is the firepower of 48 bigoted lobbyists. And all they could do is hang on to 45 people who had to stay around the chamber and vote their party whip. And there were so many people who didn't. I know some of them were just in cabinet, and so maybe they organised that, I don't know. But it seems to me that a parliamentary process wasn't ever going to get anywhere, obviously, because it is political, not as an individual politician matter. I completely agree with Corey that the idea of a conscience vote is unrealistic and pays no attention to political reality. But I think that marriage equality is so obviously necessary. Marriage inequality is so obviously contrary to, for example, the Australian Labor Party's platform, that, frankly, I think that the law will be changed within the year. Well, at least by the end of next year. I really think that it won't be long after the election that it's done, because it's an awful nuisance to them. It's completely illogical, and the sooner they do it after the election, assuming that Rudd wins, the longer the fundies have to get upset about something else.
Okay, Jamie.
Can I ask Jamie a question there?
Yeah, go ahead, Corey.
Jamie, you said that it's in line with party platform. The party platform talks about marriage being between, as it currently stands in the Marriage Act, which is between a man and a woman. What makes you think that they'll change before the next conference during the next year?
Well, I don't see that the current platform prevents a policy decision. I mean, obviously, Labor platforms never prevent things that the leader wants anyway. But the reality is that the critical, insulting language was removed from the platform at the last national conference, and the whole section is about equality and ending discrimination, and then there's this anomalous thing sticking out like dog's balls at the end of the section saying, but we support the Marriage Act. Well, of course, one always supports the law as it is, but that doesn't. There's nothing there to say that we won't change it.
I'll come in there.
This is Rodney, yep.
Rodney, yes, yep. Sorry. Thanks, Tony.
Yeah, no worries.
I tend to agree with the thrust of Jamie's argument. I'm not sure about next year, but my sense about the resistance to marriage equality at a political level is that while it appears quite strong, it's also quite brittle. That, you know, of course, you get this overwhelming vote against marriage equality in the Senate. But what is really behind that? And as Jamie is saying, it's policies which actually could be easily changed or could be reinterpreted and which don't really fit in with the major parties' policies. We've already seen the Tasmanian and Victorian ALP state conferences endorse same-sex marriage, and there's no reason that other state conferences couldn't do that as well. Mm. There's a promise here from Kevin Rudd to the fundamentalists that he won't change the Marriage Act, but that, you know, that is a political thing that could change. None of the... While we had 48 lobbyists, according to Corey, running around Parliament House last week, that could also be a sign of how of a sense of their fear, of their
panic.
Desperation about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
None of them have been able to produce an opinion poll, despite the fact that there have been quite a few polls out there showing majority support for same-sex marriage. None of them have been able to produce an opinion poll which shows the opposite. Mm. So clearly those opinion polls are reflecting something significant. The ones that show majority support for same-sex marriage are reflecting something significant and real in the Australian population. And we can be sure that both major parties know that. They know that the majority opinion is on the side of equality.
Right.
And so do the fundamentalists. So if there's a whole bunch of them turning up there, that's because they know that this is a brittle opposition
right.
to
Hopefully
same-sex marriage, and that they need to maintain it at all costs with all the resources at their disposal.
Hopefully it's their dying last gasp effort. Look, can I just put a position to you guys? Maybe this is a bleak opinion, because Jamie, you just gave a very optimistic prognosis that we should have marriage equality next year. But can I put it that what you said at the start of the conversation, that, well, let's put it this way, that the number crunchers in the secret Labor Party bunker or whatever are doing the numbers and they're saying, we will always have LGBT people on our side because we compare better to the, we compare well to the coalition. So if people are concerned about LGBT rights, they'll vote for us. And so we've got them. We're really worried about the religious loonies in those key marginal seats in Queensland, and we always have to keep them on side. So we're kind of stuck in a rut and we'll never change. Maybe, Jamie, can I get you first on that? You're the optimistic one.
I think that parties rely on extremists at their peril. Both major parties, of course, really want to get the centre and a little bit onto the other side of the centre to get to steal the opposition votes. Our vote is not just us. It's our mums and our dads, our sons and our daughters, our brothers, our sisters, our workmates. Some of it is up to us to get people to realise that they should be voting for equal marriage, and so they tell the opinion polls that. And we've been doing this for 30 years, and it works. Equality is a fundamental Australian principle. Hasn't been fundamental in its performance until fairly recently, but people are keen on it. frankly, I don't think that it matters very much to the number crunchers. I think that it's an issue where they inherited a position. They were snookered in 04. They made a terrible, the Labour Party made a terrible decision in circumstances where you can sort of understand what was going on.
Right, just to explain to the listener, this is when the same-sex marriage ban came in, supported by Liberal and Labour. Yep.
Yeah, well, it was a Liberal government move to snooker Labour. Yep. Labour gave in, I think, unnecessarily, but anyway, they did. That's shameful. As Rodney's pointed out, both the Tasmanian Labour Party and the Victorian Labour Party most recently have already carried resolutions calling for an end to the marriage ban, calling for marriage equality. And look at some the extremists in outer Queensland or outer Melbourne electorates. I'm not quite sure where they all are. They have so many other issues that I very much doubt that they're enormously counted.
Right.
Whereas mainstream Australia, which is, as I say, is not just us, but it's our mums and dads and brothers and sisters and workmates, believe in equality. They can't see any reason. They're on our side.
Okay. Look, can I
point to the recent Senate inquiry into Green's bill that was just defeated? But the inquiry report was absolutely fascinating. All the discussion and the argument, and the Senate inquiry reported on those in favour and those against, and I spoke to them with my Liberty hat on in favour of equality with one of my colleagues from Victorian Council for Civil Liberties. But the report set out the arguments. It was very clear that the report considered the argument in favour of marriage equality was undoubtedly the correct one. And they basically did, a bit like the party platform, they set it all out, they showed why equality should come, and then they came to the surprising last sentence, but we oppose passage of the bill. That's right. The politics. They went as far as they could to say, of course you're right, we're not allowed to say it.
So they set it up to just remove that last line effectively. Corey, can I bring you in now?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things going on here. The first thing that the Labor Party is aware of is that a number of people in the game has been community vote liberal, and potentially bringing back gay and lesbian voters to the Labor Party because they do something like same-sex marriage really isn't going to change the outcome of any election or any particular politician's seat, except when you start going across the other spectrum and start talking about an ALP Greens environment. So when we start talking about Lindsay Tanner's seat of Melbourne, and we talk about the fact that he's currently on 4.7% margin, there's speculation that the Greens will win across the board in Victoria 5%. If a situation like Lindsay Tanner losing his seat occurs, and same-sex marriage is an issue in that electorate vocally at a grassroots level, the people who are crunching the numbers will start worrying. Labor Party lost a seat over in Fremantle, WA, to the Greens. They're under threat here in Melbourne. They're in threat in the inner city Sydney seats. There's some speculation they could be in threat because of Anna Bligh up in Queensland's inner city seats of Brisbane as well. It's actually where it matters that people will make a change to policy quicker than others.
All right.
So we need to see some polling done in Melbourne. We need to see whether this is an issue that's going to change the voters.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also need to see people like Lindsay Tanner come out and show their personal support, not just their party's policy support during an election, to say that I personally agree with this, but yes, I want to be bound by caucus.
When they're feeling pressure from the Greens. Okay, you guys, we're going to have to speed it up a little bit. So, well, this sounds like that once we get through this year's election, the scene could change dramatically, presuming Kevin Rudd wins. Can I just get you guys, this is just a bit of fun, not very serious, but because we do like to make predictions here, we like to talk about the psychics and make our own predictions. Can I get you guys to lock in a date for when Australia will get full marriage equality? And I promise to send an official reality check cupcake to the winner when we finally get marriage equality. So maybe, Rodney, what date would you like to lock in?
Well, I'll never forget a prominent American marriage equality activist saying to me in Canada a few years ago that whatever period you think it will take, halve it.
Wow.
So I generally think about, 5 years. So going on her advice, that means 2.5 years. So that means 2012, 2013.
All right, so let's lock you in for end of 2012.
2012, 2013, yeah.
All right. Corey, what about you?
1st of Jan, 2016.
Okay, very specific. And Jamie, it looks like you're 2011. Is that what you're going for?
It certainly will be 2011. Rodney, I think is my memory failing me? I thought 2 weeks ago that you've now halved yourself again, but I think that's a good idea. I'm glad of it.
Yes, no, that's right. I did say 10 years.
Wow. Well, see, good old exponential process. Look, I'd say 2011. If you want a date, oh, just for fun, I'll say the 13th of August, 2011.
Oh, for me, it's the 10th of December.
Well, that'd be a better date, wouldn't it?
Okay, so now I've got some fixed, locked-in numbers there I can work with to see who gets the reality check cupcake. I hope Jamie's right. Well, at least I hope we get it in the next 5 years, at least. Okay, sorry, guys, we're going to have to speed it up a little bit here because we've got about 5 minutes left and I still want to talk about adoption and other issues. So just very briefly with adoption, currently, as I understand it, there's only two... Oh, well, marriage is a federal issue in Australia. Adoption is an issue for the states and territories. And at this moment, there's only Western Australia and the ACT that have full adoption rights. That is, they allow a same-sex couple to jointly adopt a child, whether it's a relative of theirs or not. Now, how are the states going to fall in the adoption game? Maybe can I go back to you, Rodney?
When you ask how they're going to fall, you mean...
And how soon are they going to get it? Who's going to be next?
Well, it's...
Tasmania has been making some progress.
I expect a debate on this in Tasmania after the election,
mm-hmm.
Because, of course, we allow known child adoption, but not adoption, as you said, of children relinquished by other people, and I think that's going to come up again. In fact, I'm sure that's going to come up again. And I would imagine that it will come up again in New South Wales after their election, and possibly in South Australia when they come to address the issue of parenting rights, although I'm not so sure whether that will occur after the election or not. The big issue I think we have with adoption is, and I think this same issue runs through the marriage debate, and that is some legislators seem to draw a line between the idea of recognising same-sex relationships that currently exist, say, as de factos, recognising same-sex families that currently exist, say, where you've got a child where one partner adopts it and they're already looking after that child. But the idea of creating a same-sex relationship through solemnising a marriage or creating a family led by a same-sex couple by allowing them to adopt someone else's child, that seems to be the problem for a lot of legislators. And I think if there's an obstacle in people's attitudes that we need to get over, it's that there's nothing wrong with the state allowing legal relationships or allowing legally recognised families to come into existence. That seems to be the fault line that Kevin Rudd draws when he says, you know, it's fine if you allow adoption for a family that already exists, but not for one that doesn't yet exist. Mm. Or if you allow, say in the Queensland surrogacy debate, it was okay to recognise a family that already exists, we've got two mums and a kid through IVF, but not one that comes into existence through surrogacy. This, I think, is a problem for some of our legislators, and we need to get over that hurdle.
Right. Corey, what's your prognosis?
Look, there's been for the last 2 years Victoria referred off to the National Council of Community Services Ministers the issue of adoption when Victoria brought in their ART, Artificial Reproductive Technology, and surrogacy laws in December 2007, announced what they were going to do.
Right.
And that has also been referred to by New South Wales when they decided not to proceed. So I think it's going to be that process. It's going to be after the New South Wales election, which means Victoria, the federal government and New South Wales will have all done their election cycles,
yep.
And that process will engage in public dialogue. I don't think we're going to have adoption in Australia until every state allows surrogacy. I don't think we're going to have adoption in Australia until South Australia catches up on parenting presumptions to recognise lesbian mothers on birth certificates. And I think that Australians need to realise that 90% of the adoption cases we're talking about here are known child adoptions.
Right. Okay, Jamie, very quickly, 20 seconds, what's your prognosis?
I've got nothing to add to that. I think both Rodney and Corey are on the money, and I'll go with them. But what I would like to talk about is the framework in which it'll be easier to make it happen, and that is having a proper Anti-Discrimination Act at the federal level.
Okay, I want to get onto that in just a second. So, but basically the general idea I'm getting from you guys is that this is going to be a slower process, a gradual piecemeal process, and we might even get marriage at the federal level before even some states have got adoption.
Agreed.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, that's quite possible.
Okay. Now, finally, and I'll give you 15 seconds each because we're running out of time. Maybe I'll start with you, Corey. What else is to be done? I know that you're a big campaigner for the anti-discrimination legislation. Can you just tell us about that and anything else that remains to get full legal equality?
I'll let Jamie talk about anti-discrimination legislation, okay. But it's also very important to note that once you've got full legal equality, or even where we're at now, where we've got 85% full legal equality in terms of number of changes, it's now a process for the gay and lesbian community to move over from legal equality to policy equality or to social equality. It's things like lesbian pap smears. It's things like being recognised in the social inclusion agenda. It's things that recognise diversity within the context of Australia. And we as a community need to wrap our head around exactly what are our policy priorities now that we're starting to move past and having successfully obtained our legal priorities.
Right. Okay. Rodney, what about you?
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, it's absolutely essential that we focus on these policy priorities, particularly in education and health. With the Commonwealth taking more of a role in setting education curriculum, for instance, we saw that just today, and in health priorities with hospitals and such like, it's absolutely essential that we have a national agenda that puts LGBTI issues in education and health. Mm-hmm. We've seen that at a state level in some states and not others, but as the Commonwealth takes over these areas more and more, we need to be working at a Commonwealth level at this, and so far we haven't done that.
Right. And Jamie, just 15 seconds from you.
Well, I absolutely agree with both of those. The legal framework is important, an Anti-Discrimination Act is an important part of that framework. The Commonwealth needs one. But implementation, getting it to happen on the ground. In Victoria, discrimination on the ground of sexual orientation has been unlawful since the beginning of 1996, but service delivery is still done in a way that doesn't actually think about us. There may be no overt, oh, you're a poof to go away. There may still be some of that. But the process of actually having a queer-friendly service environment is still only rudimentary. It's very hard to get people to change their work practices, their KPIs and all of that, to change the culture so that they are all queer-friendly. And we have two excellent committees that advise ministers, the Attorney-General's Advisory Committee on Queer Issues and the Health and Human Services Minister's Advisory Committee on GLBTI Health and Wellbeing. And those committees have been working both on the legislative structural stuff and on implementation. Implementation is the hardest.
Okay. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. We're out of time, unfortunately. Rodney Croom, Corey Earlham and Jamie Gardner, the three greatest LGBT activist minds in Australia at the moment. Thank you very, very much for joining us here on Reality Check.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Tony. My cheeks are blushing too hard to bear.
Okay, now finally, before we get into another song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com, and you can visit our webpage too. That's realitychecktony.online.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Hi, I'm Cyndi Lauper, and if you just want to have fun, do you? Keep listening to Joy 94.9 FM.
All day, all day, all night. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was All Good Things Come to an End by Canadian singer Nelly Furtado. And that song came out in 2006. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the movie up for review this week is the latest offering from director Kathryn Bigelow, The Hurt Locker. Now, interestingly, both The Hurt Locker and Avatar received 9 nominations for Academy Awards to be presented this coming Sunday, meaning that Kathryn Bigelow will be competing against her former husband, James Cameron, in both the Best Picture and Best Director categories. And I have to say that if there were a competition just between those two, I would definitely hope that Catherine Bigelow wins. She actually won in both those categories at last week's BAFTA Awards in London. So things are looking hopeful for her in Hollywood in a few days' time. The Hurt Locker tells the story of three members of a US Army EOD unit based in Baghdad in 2004. Now, what's an EOD unit? Well, EOD stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal. So they're the bomb squad, in other words. They get called in whenever anyone finds an unexploded bomb or a suspicious-looking device. And they have to move in and try to defuse it. And as you can imagine, this makes for a lot of knife-edge tension throughout the whole movie. In fact, the bomb disposal sequences make up pretty much the whole story. The film is basically just a series of six or seven very well-crafted set pieces involving bombs or a sniper, with not much else going on in the meantime. Well, yeah, there are a few tensions and conflicts between the main characters, but the strength of the film really lies in those nerve-wracking set pieces. And I must say they are really well done. At first, you're thrown into the confusion of the situation along with the characters. They arrive at a scene and have to quickly assess what's going on and what they need to do. We, the viewer, don't know what's going on at first, but it doesn't matter because the mechanics and geography of the situation quickly become clear and you rapidly work out what's happening. And I think this is where Catherine Bigelow's direction really excels, at orienting the viewer into the situation without spelling anything out too obviously. She's also very good at raising the tension in each scene. How sensitive is the explosive device? How soon will it go off? And who are those people watching from the balcony of a nearby building? Are they just curious Iraqis or are they controlling the bomb? And actually, this is probably the element that I found most revealing about this film, that it helped you to see the Iraqi civilian population through the eyes of the US soldiers on the ground. Now, of course, we know that over 99.9% of Iraqi civilians are not terrorists, are not involved in the insurgency, are completely normal, friendly people who just want to get on with their lives. But from the point of view of the US soldier, exposed out in the middle of the street with a bomb nearby that could explode any minute, being watched by sometimes hundreds of Iraqi civilians from rooftops, windows, and balconies all around him, it must be impossible to know who to trust. He must feel completely vulnerable and highly agitated. And I think Catherine Bigelow captured this sense of an impending invisible danger extremely well. What would be really fantastic now, well, now that we've seen the situation in Baghdad from the perspective of a US soldier, it would be great now to see a film where we get the same insight from the point of view of the Iraqi civilians. What must it be like for an Iraqi to have to deal with constantly jittery and suspicious American soldiers, as well as deal with the threat of bombings and religious violence from other Iraqis? It would be great to see this conflict from both sides, not necessarily the broader political issues, which the Hurt Locker doesn't really touch on at all, but just through the eyes of the people who are living it there on the ground. So maybe the Hurt Locker would be made even more illuminating with a companion piece, something like Clint Eastwood did with Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, one telling the story from the American's perspective and one from the Japanese. Now, the other great thing about The Hurt Locker is that it was written by Mark Boll, a freelance journalist who was embedded with a US Army bomb squad in Iraq. Now, he tried to convey as truthfully as he could the reality of life on the ground there. This, combined with the fact that the film was shot entirely on location in Jordan using real Iraqi refugees to play the Iraqis, adds a really gritty sense of realism to the whole project. So The Hurt Locker is certainly a great film with wonderful set pieces and a sense of realism that really draws you in. Probably the main problem with the film, though, is that the overall story is actually not that interesting and the characters are not particularly endearing either. I didn't really care that much about what happened to them in the end. And the other problem is that because the tension is high for most of the movie, well, sometimes it's just a bit too much. I found that my brain couldn't remain highly focused on the tension for such a long time, and there were moments when my mind started to wander in the middle of a tense scene. I think I would have preferred perhaps a little bit less tension and a bit more plot. But overall, I'd have to say I did enjoy The Hurt Locker. I don't think I'd put it up there with the best films of the decade, as many critics are doing. It has a score of 97% on the Rotten Tomatoes website, for example. But in my opinion, it's definitely a film worth checking out if you get the opportunity. Now, just before we conclude today's show, I just wanted to let you know that I'm having a week off from Reality Check next week. So I'll be back in 2 weeks on March 15th. And doing the show next week will be Sonia and Kaz, the regular presenters of Sci-Fi and Squeam here on Joy 94.9. And they may be joined by some special guests as well. So to hear their skeptical take on life, tune in next Monday at 8 o'clock. That brings us to the end of the 30th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 8 o'clock next Monday for the special episode presented by Sonia and Kaz. Have a great week, everyone. Coming up now is An Awkward Pause. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.